Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
You know, this is the Shortcoat Podcast, Cole Chaney. Where'd he go? He left. Nobody leaves in the middle. Cole Chaney, this is the Shortcoat Podcast, and we don't just sit around talking about news and news that medical students can use or offering people insightful analysis of current events in medicine, medical education, and the latest and possibly accurate scientific reporting in the media. That's not what we're all about, really. No, we are going right to the source of research findings, right to the very researchers who are finding the findings. It's research day here at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, and we're lucky to have with us Tyler Olson.
Hello.
Emmy Dumick. Did I do it?
Yes, you did.
Oh, my God. Ezekiel Brown. Zeke.
Yes, hello.
And Dave Peters. Hey. I didn't realize Dave was coming. That's cool. Thank you, Dave, for joining us today. Each of you have engaged in research projects in, what, the past year? More than that?
Past summer.
Yeah. Okay, so past summer. Have you guys been in research projects before? Mm-hmm. Have you ever done research before this summer?
This past year.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else?
Yeah, I've done research kind of off and on throughout my life.
Zeke, okay.
Yeah. This is the first experience I've had, so.
All right.
And I did a little bit in undergrad.
So,
I think it's worth explaining the structure of this research program. I don't want to steal your thunder.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's excellent.
So, someone here, I think, Tyler, explain how you get this grant, the way that you go about it, and then what the expectations of are once you start the
program. Great. So with my program, it might have been a little bit different. My program was in the Department of Sports Medicine, and basically I had to fill out a pre-application to apply to see if I could even do that within the sports medicine program. And then the Summer Research Fellowship, we basically wrote an application, did a little bit of pre-research, I guess, identified a PI or a principal investigator that we would like to work with. We investigated and discussed a topic to work with on them. And essentially after that, we put in a pre-manuscript, or not necessarily manuscript, but put in an application discussing what we'd like to research for the summer. And then that went to the application board.
Is that the same as the IRB? Is that different?
No, this was just basically a research team board assembled of different members deciding who would be allowed to do the summer research fellowship.
So, Emmy, what motivates you to do something like this? I mean, you could just take all summer off and have fun, right? So what? How do you get sucked into something like this?
Well, you can still have fun while doing research. Of course you know, can. It depends on your interests. For me, I prefer much more of a clinical aspect versus kind of bench work or basic science. So for me, I was interested in psychiatry to begin with, and that's psychology is my undergrad major as well. So I've kind of gone forward with that and just kind of trying to do research that can actually affect a person's life and like help them down the road, I think, is kind of what got me definitely interested.
Emmy, you looked at the role of major depressive disorder on sexual function in adolescents.
Yes.
Why'd you choose that particular topic?
Well, it was very accessible data, for one. It's based off of a data set from a longitudinal study that my mentor actually did, looking at the effects of SSRI treatment on bone metabolism. And within that, they had patients coming in for already 2 years, basically, coming in every 4 months and filling out a plethora of questionnaires, et cetera. And sexual functioning happened to be one of the questionnaires that they filled out. And so he handed me the packet and was like, look through this, see what looks interesting. And that's what I picked. So.
And what did you find?
Well, if you would have gone to my presentation this morning, Cole Chaney, you would have known.
Oh, no. I had my own to take care of.
Just kidding. So what we found was that individuals with what we distinguished as major depressive episode, so who were depressed at the time of study entry, what we found was that those individuals had lower sexual functioning than their non-depressed counterparts. So we first split the participants, and there were 235 participants, so it was a pretty good sample size. And we split those into an MDE versus no MDE group, and then further split that into males and females. So we were able to compare females to females, males to males, and then also females to males throughout. And basically, depression has a negative effect on sexual functioning.
Was that expected?
Based on the adult data, yes, but this is something that has never been done before, and there simply isn't research out there on adolescents. I scoured and couldn't find anything, so it's semi-expected, but it seems to be a taboo topic.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we're talking about you know, what a lot of people think of as kids, and kids don't have sex.
Yeah.
Kids don't.
Supposedly.
Supposedly. But Does it suggest anything that can that should be done about this, or did you not go that far?
We haven't been able to go that far yet because this was at study entry. We have the longitudinal data to assess for the two-year span. And so what we're looking at, we found that SSRIs weren't actually didn't have a significant effect on these individuals, but they had only been on SSRI treatment for like 25 days. And it usually takes 4 to 6 weeks for SSRIs to take effect. So what we want to continue to do is look at the longitudinal data and see if there is an effect of SSRIs down the road. And SSRIs have actually in the adult population been shown to increase sexual dysfunction. So we want to see if that actually does get worse.
So what we know is that just being essentially just having being depressed decreases sex sexual function, and then on top of that, you have the potential for SSRIs to do the same.
Exactly. Kind of like as an added side effect.
Right.
So, yeah, and then we're going to hopefully also see whether if in individuals where the depression remits, if their sexual function gets better, or if it's something where you can't get better from that type of thing if you've had depression for so long, et cetera.
So what you found, what you've come up with here is a potentially long continuing experiment research that will take you far. Did you expect to, when you were starting this out, did you expect, oh, I'm going to keep doing this after this? I mean, was that your goal or did it just...
Not at all. I thought that we were just going to assess the longitudinal data to begin with and it would just be done. But what we found was that it became a lot more complicated as research tends to be. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that we had to start with kind of at baseline what was going on in order to actually be able to distinguish what was happening in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a big... long project, but hopefully a good one.
Well, that's cool because, I mean, you know, hopefully you can get this, or have you already gotten this published?
I have finished a manuscript and we have submitted it to a journal.
Cool.
So we are waiting to hear back on that.
And that's always good. I mean, that's going to sort of add to your CV and as we continue on, you know, it's going to provide you with additional opportunities maybe to get published in the future.
And for us, it was mainly trying to add to the literature since there isn't anything out there. So our biggest thing was, since we did this, we might as well add to the literature and hopefully kind of strike some gears in other researchers to start looking at this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I want to ask a question about another research experiment. I was reading through everyone's here, and so I see for Tyler, we had using sideline concussion tests, a concussion clinic. Sorry, let me repeat that into the microphone.
You're good.
Using sideline concussion tests in referral concussion clinics. So I think this seems to be an item that's hot in the news. So tell us a little bit about what you were doing.
Yeah, so this is a very hot topic in the news. You've seen the NFL, the NCAA, and recently FIFA be implicated in some legal trouble with that lawsuits. So it's obviously popular in the popular media. It's a hot topic there, but it's also a hot topic in research just because while we know some things about the pathophysiology, it's not like a concussion is easily diagnosed. It's not like a heart attack where you have a myocardial infarction. You can look up a heart enzyme, essentially, and you can say, hey, they had a heart attack. And with concussion, you can't really do that. So you can thank your doctors, thank the people that are trained in analyzing concussion, because what we learned through extensive literature review is most of concussion diagnosis is not evidence-based necessarily. It's very much a clinician decision. And clinicians use different tools, and what my study looked at was 9 of those tools, 9 different tests or concussion tests, and basically compared those against one another, because only one is validated in clinical use. So some of these are validated on the sideline. So let's say a football player comes, gets a concussion, they'll go to the sideline, and they'll have this battery of tests. And that's great for, immediately following a concussion. But when they need to come back, they go see a physician a day to a week later. Are those tests still going to be able to tell you anything at that point in time? And so that's kind of what my study's looking at. And it's an ongoing study. So we don't have publishable results yet, but that's just because we need to have more time and more participants. And as football season and soccer season continues, we expect to get a lot more too.
So I don't want you to give it away, maybe if you can't, but what... You know, I think traditionally think of they say, what year is it? Who's the president? I mean, that's the old school one. So what do they do now? What's the forefront?
Right. So that's actually one of the tests we use. The main one that has been used in clinic is a simple symptom checklist, essentially. So asking the patient on a scale of 1 to 6, do you have these 22 symptoms? And it's basically self-reported. And the patient can say, I have cloudy vision. I am depressed or anxious. Those are side effects. I have Trouble reading things that are close up. I'm vomiting. I'm nauseous. Some of these things. So that's one of the things we do. There's a reading test, speed reading test. We also assess balance in some things because concussion affects. It has physical effects. It has cognitive effects. So memory and concentration are often impaired. No behavioral, just emotional swings, mood swings. So a lot of different tests are simple finger to nose tests where we're testing coordination or having people walk a straight line. Some of your field sobriety tests. So a lot of these tests are pretty crude. And so we're actually determining, are they actually telling us as much as physicians think they might be?
Dave, I know David Peters here is a quad sport athlete. Have you ever had a concussion?
Many.
Many? Okay. Many, yeah. Tell us what happens. Give us
I was going to say something, but...
Well, one time when I was little, I was hanging on a basketball rim and my hand slipped off and hit my head on the concrete. So okay. I got one there.
Was it a 10-foot rim?
No, not really. No. I wish I could jump that high, but I got him playing soccer and I got him playing kickball at school. So my dad never let me play football in high school because he's
like,
afraid.
You've had enough.
Yeah, he's like, your brain's too valuable. Don't mess it up with that. So yeah, so it's like blurry vision, headaches.
How do they diagnose you at the time?
Oh, how did they diagnose me? I was little when I got them. I don't remember their exact techniques, but yeah, it was just a survey. It was no machinery involved or scans or anything. They just asked me questions about my symptoms.
And that's still the case. I mean, there's no visual imaging. You can't do an MRI or CT or anything. There's nothing you can really look at and say, oh yeah, they have brain damage or, you know. It's a severe brain injury, they do. But if for concussion, you can't look at an image and say that.
What about other physical findings like nystagmus and things like that? I mean, is that part of it?
Yeah. So there's different tests of balance or vestibular system, and then some cerebellar signs. So basically, if they can't touch their finger to their nose, or if they're having visual problems, that means other systems might be involved. So there are definitely physical signs and symptoms, but it's usually a functional injury where everything. The physician looks at the entire picture to see if there's deficits.
Well, by the way, as the transition, the David you just heard from did human auditory cortical activation during speech production under delayed auditory feedback. We were supposed to get simple ones here.
No. I think I know what this, but go ahead.
Hold on. Can you break that down? I just said a lot of words.
Yeah, so that it's actually not as complicated as that title makes it sound, but so all we were doing is basically seeing what kind of brain activation occurs when a person speaks under delayed auditory feedback. And delayed auditory feedback is just using a device that has a microphone and headphones, kind of like the microphone we have here and the headphones we're wearing right now. But the microphone will pick up the speaker's voice and then pause it for a fraction of a second and then send it back through the headphones. So a person is going to hear what they're saying, but it's going to be about a fraction of a second later than what it would normally be. So
and this messes you up.
Oh, it screws you up so bad.
So, you did tell me that David was going to be here, and I'm just remembering it because I remember this title. And
This
title. And we could do that on this board.
Oh, nice.
But I don't know how. I wish I had been able to take...
Oh, well, man. I actually have an app on my phone that can do it if you want a demonstration.
Grab it.
Bring it over here.
In the meantime, while David sets this up, let's talk to Zeke really quick about his research.
Sure.
What'd you do, Zeke?
So I looked at drug overdose death rates across the United States, across all 50 states and Washington, D.C., and we examined essentially the relationship between those death rates and certain economic variables.
Okay.
And what we found basically is that unemployment is positively related with drug overdose deaths, which wasn't particularly surprising. As unemployment goes up, death rates seem to go up too. What was a little surprising is that we found that median house price not only was related in the way we would expect it, which is the relation was negative, which is to say as house prices decrease,
overdose goes up.
Absolutely. But it was also very highly statistically significant. And this was even after controlling for a number of factors.
Like you think this is the most significant variable?
Yes, it was. Amongst what we looked at, that was the most significant variable. There's a number of different possibilities what was happening there. I mean, part of it is just that the housing market is what collapsed, and that's what led to the recession recently. So that's one part of the story. Another part is that when house prices decrease, that affects everyone who owns a home. And it especially affects people who have a mortgage, you know, if they end up underwater on their home or maybe they lose it, that's going to be especially detrimental to someone like that. Whereas unemployment, it affects people, but it really only affects those people who are at risk of losing their job.
Oh, but. So how do you quantify it? Someone comes in, drug overdose, though. I mean, I think, couldn't you say respiratory failure? Someone had a MI. I mean, so is that in the hospital log? How does that work?
Yeah, so that's, it's determined by the coroner. So, I mean, I think it depends what exactly was found when the body was found and just taking a history from people who are around. I mean, if it's, and then they can test blood too. If there was a lot of opioids in their blood, it becomes obvious what happened.
Is it opioids exclusively?
So people die of drug overdoses for a number of things. The majority of them, when it's unintentional or undetermined, is opioids. And it's particularly prescription opioids recently. And that's kind of been something that changed from 1999 to 2010. So they weren't, people would die of prescription opioid deaths back in 1999, but it wasn't quite as common. Throughout that decade, it became just increasingly common. And if you look at the number of purchases of these drugs, the prescriptions too, everything went up during that time. So that really kind of changed everything as far as drug use in this country. It made these pills that are kind of hardcore opioids available to just a wide swaths of the American public.
Okay. Is our app ready?
Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
So we're back, and we're going to try to sort of demo what Dave was talking about in New Hampshire research. So go.
All right. So DAF works by that. It delays the voice and then feeds it back to the headphone. So you're hearing what you would normally hear, but it's a fraction of a second later. So it's kind of like a little bit of an echo. And it sort of messes with the way that your brain works as far as speech production. And the really cool thing about it is that it has this negative effect for people who speak normally. But if you do this same effect on people who stutter or have speech problems, it'll actually correct that problem.
Oh.
So it has a reverse effect.
Uh-huh. Here, read something from somebody.
All right, I usually like sing a song or something.
Oh, well, okay. Well, go ahead.
Or maybe rap or something like that.
Of course.
Free entertainment.
Yeah. So we'll give this a try. Let me turn it on.
Let's see
it.
All right.
Here we go.
You hear that.
All right. He's wearing Beats by Dre.
Well, he did say he was going to rap for us.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me think one more. His arms are heavy, knees weak, mom's getting vomit on his sweater already, mom's getting nervous, but on the surface it looks calm, and he's dropped bombs, but he keeps his arms from getting
wrote down.
Wow.
Wow. I don't even know if that was successful or not.
There's a little bit of, I think, feedback from this microphone, too. But yeah, that was kind of a part demo.
The point is that it messes with, there's some, so what is the thing at work here?
So that's what we're trying to prove. We believe that there's a speech error correction system of the brain. It hasn't been proven yet, but... So we think that it utilizes something known as efferent copy. So when you have a motor action called an efferent signal going from your central nervous system to your motor system. So for speaking, it's going to be a signal that to move the muscles of your throat or the muscles of your mouth. And then once that motor action creates something, like so for in this case the sound of your voice, you hear it. And that's turned into an afferent signal, which is a sensory signal back to your brain. So your brain says, I want to speak, goes to the motor system, speech, and you hear the sound and goes back. And the sound that goes back is known as a reafferent signal. So it's sensory feedback from your own actions.
You can hear yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And so this efferent copy comes in is where at that very first signal of you thinking, I want to speak, well, one copy goes to the motor system and then another copy of that signal goes to a different part of your brain. And this other part of your brain kind of analyzes that signal and says, and then from that signal generates what it thinks it should hear back from when you speech. And so it takes this signal that it thinks it should hear, which is called a corollary discharge, that's a name for it, and it matches that up with what it actually hears. And if they don't match up, then it'll try to make a correction to match it. And
so your brain is monitoring what you're saying and making corrections based on what it hears back. I feel like Neil deGrasse Tyson today.
That's exactly right. Yep. So what DAF does is it screws up that reafferent signal. So your brain's going to perceive it as an error, and it's not going to match what it expects to hear. So it'll try to correct that by maybe inhibiting the muscles of your throat or your mouth, causing stuttering and speech errors. So,
but you said those people who might stutter have the reverse effect happen to them.
Right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And we think what's happening there is that, so at the point where internally in the brain, where it's analyzing that efferent copy and coming up with what it expects to hear, we think that there may be a delay in that system, so that the what it's expecting here is a little bit slow coming out, so that when you slow down the reafferent signal, they actually match up. And so that would create a more fluid speech. And this has kind of been, like, the etiology of stuttering is not well known at all, but there has been shown to be a neurological basis through fMRI studies of people who stutter compared to people who not. And this could kind of suggest that there may be a connection like that. And our data tried to isolate areas of the auditory cortex that are uniquely activated during speaking with the AF, just try to find parts that are involved in this system.
I have a question then. So the way you explain this, that is, it's almost like, if you ever see those two frequency waves, and these frequent, they're not syncing up, right? So there's some poor feedback going on here. So what would this imply to me is that different people will have different lag times on their editing software in their brain, okay? And so if this is the case, do you do different delays to fix different people's stutters is my question.
That's a great question, because it's actually been shown that there's not a one perfect delay setting that affects everybody. So by altering those parameters, you can have a great effect, or you can have a small effect, or for some people it might work better than others. So you kind of, because like these apps that they have developed for people who stutter, they have a wide range of settings where you can play with it and figure out what works best for you. So
this app that you have, I mean, it's is it designed for people who stutter?
No, the app I have is a free version that's just designed to have fun with. It only has two settings, normal and insane. So you can't really.
That sounds very scientific.
Yeah, it's just for fun. Yeah.
So does that app change, does that help improve them over time then when they're not using it? Is that like speech pathology or something?
I'm not certain about that, but I don't think it does. I think it's just like something you got to keep using if you want to keep withstanding the effects.
Sure.
So if you do have normal speech though, and you're, you know, kind of playing with the app or whatnot, is there anything that you can do to kind of negate the effects of, you know, the, I guess, your throat muscles being inhibited, etc.?
So you mean, can you do something so that you're not affected by it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you just try to ignore the feedback, then some people are better at it than others.
I was going
to
say good luck.
But. Yeah, so yeah, it's trying to tune it out, but yeah, that's pretty hard to do when it's, you know, coming through your headphones. Mm-hmm. But.
Well.
Cole, you want to try it once? Here, you should try it. I'll hook it up with...
Glad I'm getting roped in here. I think I should be off the mic, right? I should talk into the phone only.
Yeah.
Okay. So first off, can you guys hear it?
Wait.
Is it delayed?
We can hear it a little bit. Yeah.
Here. No, I think you can talk into this now because my headphones are not hooked up to the.
I will be reading Z. Brown.
Wait. Get him on get closer to the mic, please.
On the mic. To what extent can economic conditions explain the annual state drug overcome death rates observed in the United States during the years 1999 through 2010?
Cool? You sound like you've been drinking. Cool.
I have never. That's brilliant. I have never heard. I've experienced this effect before, but I've never heard it that way. Because of course, I'm always hearing myself doing it, and I know that I can't. Oh wow, that's trippy.
But on the flip side. I don't think anyone here seems to have a stutter. I could imagine how, like, I realize that's not having a stutter, but having a speech impediment, how tough that would be. I feel like I couldn't get...
No, you can't get it out.
I couldn't get it out. Yeah, that's frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of gives you a little insight into what those people kind of feel on a daily basis, too.
Amazing. Well, oftentimes on the show, guys, we talk about things in the news, and I pulled up a couple of... things to discuss.
So chime in today. You know, we have very bright minds here.
Yeah.
The number of disciplines.
I am the dimmest mind here.
And no, Dave.
And that's saying nothing.
See, now he fishes for compliments.
I do. It's my only source of pleasure.
That and coffee.
We were saying earlier, Dave is running out of vices, apparently. That was an earlier discussion point.
Yeah.
So he's down to caffeine.
So I have caffeine and solicited comments, or solicited compliments.
Off-track betting.
An article in Forbes magazine this week, or on Forbes website, asks, are scientists selfish about sharing their data? So this is trying to explain why scientists are so tight-lipped about their work until it gets published in a reputable peer-reviewed publication. And the gist is that all has to do with the movement of a new PhD to becoming, you know, a tenured professor. So the newly minted PhD scrambles for work on their more experienced counterparts' research for a while. And hopefully she gets her name in a bunch of papers and begins to build her name up until someday she can set up her own lab, which then requires a constant cycle of publish, get funding, publish, until she gets some relief by being awarded tenure. And what they're saying is the top publications hold all the keys here. Being published in a less respected journal doesn't really help in this question for money and security. And so these journals want exclusivity. They don't want the scientist sharing her results before they get to publish that scientist's big breakthroughs. This is obviously probably not something you guys have all run into yet, but, you know, does this figure into the back of the minds of your, like, PIs, do you think, when you're doing this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, so my mentor is a health economist, and I know in that field it's a little bit different. I mean, you don't get your own lab, but there's a strong competition to get published. And I think for the most part, there is a lot of camaraderie, but I think it creates this kind of strange phenomenon where people are trying to get not just lots of things published, but the journals themselves often they don't want kind of boring results, even though this is kind of what pushes science forward. Mm-hmm. Instead, they want these really interesting results that you can get headlines and newspapers from.
Yeah.
And I think that's just kind of to protect their own profit model, to be honest.
Well, I mean, what's always been interesting to me is that, you know, if we get negative results, so we get the results that are, no, we didn't find what we want. That's also potentially important.
Absolutely.
But that's not typically what people want to publish.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Was it we learned in class, it was a 3-to-1 ratio of positive to negative. Is that right?
Yeah.
Something
publication
like that.
Bias. Yeah. Public, there we go. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about this model is that, you know, because the journals want exclusivity, it's a problem for, you know, publicly funded research, funded by taxpayers, for patients who need the results to be available to their doctors, you know, positive or negative, that's important information. And then a lot of these results, in addition to waiting to get your stuff published in this peer-reviewed journal, the results are often behind paywalls and things like that. So I just thought it was interesting that this is a challenge for science today. And there are journals, I guess, who are sort of trying to buck that trend. I'm not sure how much. Does anybody have any ideas about how much success those efforts have been?
I was going to say, I'm not really sure. I know when we looked at, like, what journals to submit my manuscript to, we were, you kind of run into an issue of, do you want to go really, really specific into, like, for example, sexual medicine?
Right.
Or
the
Journal
of Adolescent Sexual
Medicine. Exactly. I mean, I don't think that exists, but regardless. So, or do you want to kind of go for a journal that might be more broad but can hit more potential, you know, readers? And so there's actually a scaling system that is used to rate journals. And I asked my mentor about it because he was saying, you know, higher numbers are better. And I was like, all right, but what's the maximum that you can get? Is it 0 to 100, you know, kind of thing? And he goes, there is no maximum. So as long as you're beating out the journals underneath you, you're probably going to get more manuscripts sent to you. And it's based
on... I'm not sure I understand this rating. Who's rating the journals?
So all journals are rated just based kind of on a system of kind of readership, of how many readers they get, but also kind of the vagueness or the specificity of the journal itself. And that's done... I'm not exactly sure who does the rating. It might just be some random person sitting in a basement.
Journal of Rating Journals.
Rating something or another. But
that's specific.
But they use the same, I guess, criteria for any journal across the board.
So your goal is to get your research in a journal with a high score,
basically. Yes. Unless you have something really, really specific that might go really well. So it's kind of like a toss-up. You have to think about, you know, kind of what your topic is, but also kind of like who you want your audience to be. And so I think that's a lot of the time what researchers run into in terms of especially kind of trying to hide your own research, is that you don't want somebody to beat you out in kind of, you know, finding what you found and get it to the journal that you want them, that you want to get your stuff into, and then you're stuck not getting it into that journal. Or even if you get, you know, submit your manuscript, you're still waiting there for 3 to 4 months, and this other person might go to a different journal and get it published faster. That's also the other issue that people run into.
I think one of the challenges too with that is not only that specific article that you want to publish, but you lose out if you discuss and share your results before it gets published. You can lose a market share on your follow-up studies. I mean, if you find a brand new novel technique to do something and you share it with everyone, then you're not going to have your 10 follow-up studies because other labs are going to be doing follow-up studies based off your work, where you have a 6 to a year head start on follow-up studies if it's not released until it's published data.
So it's kind of like you're stuck replicating your own.
You're investing. You're saving for the future. Results, yeah. Right.
And I know a big part of the leader of our lab, a big part of his job is securing funding, like federal grants and things like that. And that money is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So there's even more competition to acquire those grants. So yeah, you want to protect what you have so that maybe so that you can still have funding for your job in the future.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that funding for NIH research has gone down like 20% in the past few years. I mean, it's a shrinking pie, so there's all sorts of market influences here. Man, I sounded intelligent. Admire me. It's fine.
Do you find, by the way, I mean, everyone here works in a separate lab. I'm always curious about funding, so I think the classical source is the government public funding, but, you know, there's a Steve Wynn wing of the university right now, right? So, I mean, do you find your PIs are soliciting donations from these more unique sources?
These more private sources, basically, private. Yeah. Well, like the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, you know, that's sort of one of those those things.
Yeah, I think most researchers will take the money, I mean, any way they can find it. You know, they want to keep doing their research, so they'll look for all kinds of sources. So that might even direct what they go there, do their research into, because I know, like, the Steve Wynn donated money to research that's for a condition he has, so that would likely affect those researchers want to, you know, look into that condition because he's funding them. And yeah, so my PI actually had a funding from the NIH, so I should talk to him more about that. I haven't talked to him a whole lot about how that whole process works. But
medicine hates business side of anything.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not as much fun as science, you know. Right? Speaking as we often do about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, so it's been all over Facebook, and it's been a great thing for the ALSA, as we've mentioned the podcast before. Inside Higher Ed's Grad Hacker column featured an opinion piece from Jason McSheen, a Princeton PhD student in molecular biology. And he suggests that the funding bump that ALSA experienced, which was about, estimates seem to vary, but 80 to 100 million, and which doubled the NIH's planned research budget of 40 million, is really kind of a short-term success. It showed that it's possible to unite people around a funding issue, generate charitable contributions, but it's not really reasonable to assume that each organization for a disease can replicate the success and keep that money coming. He did, one of his buddies proposed the liquid nitrogen dry ice challenge. And he wants you to call your congressman to ask them to increase the NIH's funding, which, as I said before, has been decreasing quickly in the last few years. We'll just take a listen to that here.
We've got some science-y ice. We've got a random guy with spear stirring that science-y ice. So how about we get started?
Before we actually get this done, take a minute, call your congressman, get the science flowing, I guess. So with that, I guess we can give it a shot. As always, thesis ready.
He's sitting
safety
on his
first.
That's cold. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea, and maybe it will take off in the same way as the Ice Bucket Challenge, although I think we might be kind of peaking on that whole thing.
Yeah, I think I'd worry about just diminishing returns to these sorts of things. Seems like we need to get a little more outrageous each time.
Well, so. I actually read an article in which they're talking about, you know, the donations that people make, and they say, like, when a person makes a donation to one specific organization, they're much less likely to donate than in the future because they think, I've done my duty.
Done my part. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I don't need to do it anymore. So yeah. I think I definitely agree that it's going to be a short-term solution.
Or not even, or to that maybe this is what you're referring to, but wouldn't donate to another organization.
Exactly.
Final story of the day. Cornell University notes on their website that their cancer researchers are doing something unusual. They are talking to cancer patients. About their experiences with cancer. So these are conversations between researchers from a variety of departments, including chemistry, biochemistry, molecular and cell biology, pharmacology, environmental toxicology, veterinary oncology, with cancer survivors and volunteers. And so what they're trying to do is, you know, is involve researchers in presenting their findings to actual patients in lay language and sort of have some feedback from those patients to the researchers about what it's like to have cancer, what it's like to get the therapies that these researchers have worked on. I think it's kind of a cool idea. Intuitively, it seems to me like, yeah, it's probably an unusual thing for researchers to do, especially, you know, when you're talking about, you know, biomedical research. It's probably kind of unusual to go, you know, like, oh, I've, you know, researched, what did you research, Cole?
Mice. You know, it's always mice with
me. You hate mice.
I always say it's a good day for science, bad day for mice.
Right, right. Tell me, so your poster title, I don't even know what your...
I'm more interested in the story, so let's... I want to talk about that for a second.
I just wanted to... What I was trying to get at was that, you know, like, when you're researching this molecule or this receptor or something like that, you probably don't bring it to the patients who are affected by your research that often. So there's not that feedback, that completion of the loop.
Well, and the especially important thing, I think, for at least medical students, I'm sure this follows later in life too, is that you spend so much time in these books reading about the subclass of a JAK-STAT receptor, but all of a sudden, but then you get in the clinic and you're like, you see this patient who maybe has a little cirrhosis and he wants to tell you a story. Maybe he's kind of mean and surly, right? But either way, that human connection you forget actually is a huge motivating factor for a lot of why we're here. And so that's easily forgotten, I think, in a lot of labs, libraries, etc. And that's a cool aspect.
Well, science is really a long game in a lot of ways. Like, you focus on research on your topic for many, 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 many years. The payoff is distant. If that loop could sort of be closed between the research and the patient, you know, that could be a motivating factor. I don't know that probably people who go into research anyway are motivated not necessarily by, you know, short-term success, because it's, like I say, it's a long game.
And what about public perception too, you know, for funding, etc.? Obviously, we're seeing a shrinking funding environment.
That's a good, I hadn't made that connection.
So now people, when they write to their congressman or when they vote on issues, you know, they suddenly say, like, you know, I actually met this oncology researcher. He was nice, you know, maybe he's kind of like eggheady, I'm sure, right? This guy's pretty smart. He's a PhD and some biostat thing, but at least he'll make people appreciate what's going on inside the lab if you can break it down rather than just some ivory tower.
And I think helping the public to understand these kind of things is always a good thing, because then you can avoid, you know, some of those public opinions that are just blatantly false that often get passed around, you know, like the anti-vaccine movement, or there's people who think that there's already a cure for all kinds of cancer out there, but that the government's hiding it. And, you know, these kinds of wild conspiracy theories that develop because of, you know, public opinion. So I think this is a good idea for that, as well as helping them understand how these types of treatments actually do work.
I think another aspect that's important to look at is just researchers also maybe being able to see some of the side effects of their work too. Nausea and vomiting might seem really trivial when you're curing cancer, but you can also see that maybe that we should have multiple drugs. And obviously we do use multiple drugs to control side effects, but side effects might be something that aren't on the forethought of many researchers' minds when they're creating new drugs, but they're definitely not trivial things to patients.
Good point. Well, listen, you guys, it's been great. I want to thank you for coming on the show today and taking time out. Good luck in your efforts in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. But what I see is a child.